Welcome to Shir 50, where we will discuss the future observance of Shemitah based on information from around 1970 or so, and therefore take whatever we are saying with the knowledge that it may or may not be accurate with regard to Shemitah today. So this chapter is also written a bit differently, so I'm going to be trying to summarize and reading parts of it inside. The question of Shemitah in Eretz Yisrael is unique, as the issue of Shemitah touches on the very question of the sovereignty of God in relationship to Eretz Yisrael, and even to the whole world. The Sifra and the Gemara in Sanhedrin state that if we work in the seventh year, we are going to be exiled. The Gemara is specifically commenting on a disputation between the Roman Emperor, Jewish heretics, and the Chachamim, and the topic was the essence of the Torah and Jewish nationhood, and this will be something that we will get back to. Shemitah and Yovel have basic underlying ideas that belong to the essence of the Jewish philosophy of life. Shemitah holds the key to the visible manifestations of God's glory on earth, human dignity, freedom, equality, trust in God, rejection of the worship of property, support of the poor, care for creatures, striving to be free from the fetters of making a living one day a week and one year out of seven. So the farmer is given 12 months of undisturbed leisure to devote himself to Torah and to the higher values of life, and especially its highest value, which to the sincere believer is Malchus Shemayim, the acceptance of the sovereignty of God, his guidance and rulership of individual as well as collective existence. Throughout our generations, there are thinkers that delve deeply into the meaning of Shemitah. We have from Medrash, Mishnah, the Talmud, the Gaonim, the Rambam, the Abarbanel, etc., 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 all the way down to modern times, specifically Rav Hirsch, Rabbi Yonis and Eibishitz, Rav Kalischer, Rav Cook, and many, many more. The practical observance of Shemitah has also never been lost sight of by our codifiers, from the Mishnah, to Tosefta, the Yerushalmi, the Rambam, and although Rabbi Yosef Karo doesn't really discuss Shemitah per se, he only discusses Shemitah's Kesafim. There's Rabbi Yisrael of Shklov's famous work, Pa'as HaShulchan, with a commentary by the Ridbaz. And we know that many, many works have been devoted to the practical observance of Shemitah. Before we deal with the future of Shemitah observance, it may be useful to present a short summary of Shemitah observance in the past. There could be no doubt that in the days of the Second Commonwealth, special care was given to it, so as to make up for its lack during the First Commonwealth, destruction of which was, according to the explicit words of the Torah, due to the neglect of Shemitah. We are now going to quote from a historical study of Shemitah, and this was written by someone named B. Zuckerman. At the restoration of the Second Temple, when the religious feelings of the returning captives were free from the impurities of idolatry and immorality, and when the people eagerly sought to conform in all their social and political acts to the precepts of the Chumash, the regulations concerning the sabbatical year were undoubtedly enforced. Not merely the Shabbos of the land, but also the counting of the sabbatical cycles was at that time practically observed. This point demands no elaborate demonstration. Whoever is in some measure conversant with the literature posterior to the exile must be fully convinced of this truth. Since, however, skepticism penetrates every branch of knowledge and professes to deny the actual observance of the sabbatical laws after the captivity, we deem it necessary to bring under notice some testimonies which bear the impress of historical validity. And we've actually quoted parts of this in our chapter on the observance of Shemitah in Jewish history, but he sums it up as follows. These data collectively furnish evidence which disarms every doubt respecting the fact that the Shemitah years were practically observed. Not merely the celebration, but also the counting of the sabbatical years was practiced after the captivity. After the destruction of the second Beis HaMikdash, so the laws of Shemitah were still observed, And this observance starts well before the actual Shemitah year, called Tosefes Shavias, and it took a special decision of Rabban Gamliel and his Beis Din that allowed plowing until the settling in of the Shemitah year on the first of Tishrei, contrary to the stricter usage that prevailed before, right? Obviously, you don't have to make a special rule from Beis Din if it wasn't out of the ordinary. We find in the Yerushalmi that the intention of Rabbi Yehuda I, who wanted to allow work during Shemitah due to economic stress, which in his opinion reached a dangerous level, was opposed to by Rav Pinchas ben Yair and his colleagues, who did not consider that there was a condition of danger. They did not consider that it reached the level of pikuach nefesh. We find during the times of the Amoraim, the Gemara times, that Shemitah was strictly observed. The first person that we find to permit and even encourage working during Shemitah was Yanai. And as we discussed, whether his permission to work during Shemitah was due to economic stress and strain in the country or danger to life for the Jewish farmers dealing with the Roman officials, so that's something which is controversial. That economic pressure alone did not prevent Jewish farmers in that period of our history from observing the sabbatical year is borne out by the following enthusiastic praise of our Midrashic sages. Baruchu Hashem Malachov Gibore Choach Ose Devaro L'shmoa B'kol Devaro. Bless the Lord, you angels of His, you mighty in strength that fulfill His word. Listen to the voice of His word. Said Rabbi Yitzchak, this verse of the psalm refers to those who observe the Shemitah year. Ordinarily, a man does a good deed on a day during the week. But the Shemitah observer sees his field lie fallow, his vineyard untended. Nevertheless, he pays taxes and imposts from his land in the sabbatical year. Is there a greater hero than he? A similarly moving passage, whose historical background is also Roman occupation, after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, we find this in Eicher Abasi. They that sit in the gate talk of me, and I am the song of the drunkards. Rabbi Abahu applied this verse to the nations of the world. When they sit in their theaters and circuses, eat and drink, and become intoxicated, they call of me, of Yisrael, scoffing at me and saying, we have no need to eat carob bread like the Jews. They then take a camel covered with a black cloth into their theaters and ask one another, why is the camel in mourning? To which they reply, as the Jews observe the law of the sabbatical year, they have no vegetables to eat. They therefore consume this camel's thorns, and that is why it is in mourning. We have found that non-Jews throughout history have mocked our religious observance of the Jews, whose civilizing influence on man they never really understood. So what does a Jew do every week? He forgoes many amenities of life and opportunities to improve his material position for the sake of Shabbos. It doesn't make any sense for a person who never appreciated the spiritual treasures that lie hidden behind the laws of Shabbos observance. So to a non-initiate, it's something which is life-crippling, and it's not worth any sacrifice. But these same people don't realize that by this act of keeping Shabbos, man puts a limit on his labor so that it doesn't degenerate into purposeless, meaningless work, just like a chore. By keeping Shabbos, the Jew becomes Dome Eliyotzro, like the God who formed him, in that, like God, he becomes a master of his work and not its slave, which he must never become. Right, so it's an interesting point. How many workers realize that when they have off on the weekend, that this is due to the Shabbos observing Jew? And this spreads the idea that man is not a working machine. It is a long way indeed from the Greek and Roman conception of labor as degrading, with the resultant lack of rights of the laborer, to the present-day status of the working man. Similarly, it was the Jew who observed the festival of unleavened bread and thereby kept green the memory of the redemption from Egyptian slavery and thus preserved the ideal of human freedom. The same applies to the sabbatical year, which has driven home the truth that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Without this demonstration, man would have forgotten the world-redeeming message of the sovereignty of God, which alone could put an end to strife and bloodshed among nations. During our long galus, when our people yearned to return back to Eretz Yisrael, where they could fulfill mitzvos hatluyos ba'aretz. One of these wishes has always been to fulfill Shemitah. We find that disobedience to Shemitah means exile. And we find that our people have, with single-minded dedication and under great sacrifices, have attempted to solve the seeming contrast between the sublime visionary ideal of Shemitah and Yovel and the stark realities of economic and political life. We find in Nehemiah that the people made an oath to observe Shemitah, and this was faithfully observed. Our Chachamim say, Nechshedu Yisrael al Hashviyas, that the Jewish people cannot always be trusted with regard to the observance of Shemitah, that this is a sad reflection of the economic difficulties encountered by Jewish farmers, who they try their best to fulfill this mitzvah, and enactments of our Chacham, who found these necessary to make in order to safeguard Shemitah. The Torah, the Gemara, etc., everything warns us that not observing Shemitah causes galus to come, and that the Jews are exiled. The Torah tells us that when we're exiled, then the land enjoys her Shabbos, in that it lies desolate. And now that we've returned to Eretz Yisrael, one would have expected that Shemitah observance would have been strengthened to safeguard our stay in Eretz Yisrael and to prevent a third exile. And then unfortunately it didn't work out due to the economic difficulties. One can understand the disappointment of everyone in Eretz Yisrael when, unfortunately, there were difficulties with observing Shemitah. We have discussed in detail the controversy around the Heter Mechira, and the question's been asked, how is it that no one has ever put forth a Heter Mechira before? And the idea of such a legal device was never contemplated, and why should it be that now it should be contemplated, when our tefillos and our dream of returning to Eretz Yisrael has finally become a reality? And only the fear of the very existence of the Yeshuv can account for the decision of some of our Rabbanim to introduce the Heter Mechira. And we know for a fact that the Heter Mechira was supposed to be temporary, and it was justified only due to extraordinary circumstances. And by the time this Sefer was written, he says that 12 Shemitah cycles have passed, and what was supposed to be temporary is still with us. So based on this backdrop, let's discuss now the future observance of Shemitah. Anyone familiar with the position in Israel will realize that the way Shemitah is now observed in the religious kibbutzim, apart from those of the Poalei Agudas Yisrael, is far removed from what was envisaged by the originators of the Heter Mechira. A number of agricultural activities are now carried out by otherwise observant Jewish farmers during Shemitah, which neither the original Matirim nor of Cook, who continued the Heter, ever permitted. The Heter Mechira, which originally was a Horas Shah, seems to have become a permanent institution. Now, at the same time, we know that there are thousands of families who go through great sacrifices to consume food which is produced without infringing upon any of the laws of Shemitah, or are imported, or are bought from local Arabs. And this itself apparently has been problematic. If we want to extend the proper observance of Shemitah from a limited circle to most of the Orthodox community in Eretz Yisrael, so we need to look to the leaders of the Kibbutz HaDa'ati for support, for a major breakthrough with regard to Shemitah observance will not occur until there is a change in their attitude. We already know that in the Kibbutz HaDa'ati there's a school of thought which leans towards stricter observance of Shemitah and is inclined to avoid the Heter Mechira, and they actively look for halachic solutions. However, the supporters of this are really a minority. Most of the leaders of the Kibbutz HaDa'ati hold that the stricter observance of Shemitah is incompatible not only with the economic survival of the kibbutzim, but also with the economic and security conditions of the state of Israel as a whole. And I'm just going to read directly. The present writer is fully aware of the serious position in which the state of Israel finds itself, subject to an economic blockade by the surrounding Arab states who try their utmost to pressurize those countries in Europe who depend upon Arab oil into accepting their boycott of Israel. Moreover, those Arab states make no secret of their intention to destroy the state of Israel and wipe out its inhabitants. The present writer is also very reluctant to preach from afar to Jewish settlers in Israel whose sincerity, single-mindedness, and self-sacrificing spirit are obvious to all. Nevertheless, the question of Shemitah observance is such a crucial one for the future of the Jewish state that it seems imperative to subject the arguments advanced by the leaders of the Kibbutz HaDa'ati to a closer scrutiny. For, in the present writer's opinion, it is the leaders of the Kibbutz HaDa'ati who hold the key in their hands, which enables them to open the gate to a wider and stricter observance of Shemitah in the state of Israel. So we have already discussed all the various halachic opinions, even though we didn't get into complete detail on everything. We gave a pretty good overview of everything, and it was done in a hopefully fairly objective manner. And now, to quote further, it is not for the present writer to adjudicate between the views of the halachic giants whose opinions have been presented. Vani eini kedai lahachnis roshi bein aharim ha'ila. What prompts me to write the following pages is my deep religious conviction that the future of the present Jewish Commonwealth in the Holy Land will depend on the way and extent of Shemitah observance. On the ideological basis of the law of the Shemitah year, there is no difference of opinion. Following the great Jewish thinkers, past and present, and especially the matchless presentation by Rav Kook in the introduction to his work, Shavos Ha'aretz, the leaders of the Kibbutz HaDati have been tireless in expounding and propagating these religious and social ideals in many essays and brochures. The designation by Tzuriel Admonit, the leader of Kibbutz Yavne and an influential ideologist of the Kibbutz movement, of the laws of Shemitah as the constitutional blueprint of the Torah state is very appropriate indeed. It is different, however, when the same author writes in the same essay, in the case of such messianic mitzvos, it is our duty to erect signposts so that they shall not be forgotten and look like something new in our eyes when we shall merit to fulfill them again in their entirety. But Shemitah is not, in the opinion of the overwhelming majority of our halachists, a hilchasa l'mashicha. And although the Shemitah instructions of the chief rabbinate are supposed to be followed by the members of the Kibbutz HaDati and are followed on the whole with varied degrees of conscientiousness, it is a fact that the main stress is laid not on the observance of Shemitah itself, but on Zechar l'Shemitah, a nominal or symbolic observance. Of course, the degree of the observance of Shemitah varies in different kibbutzim, as does indeed throughout the country. As a very respected and learned member of a kibbutz wrote to me, in truth, it is rather difficult to make a clear statement with regard to the observance of Shemitah in the whole yeshuv. The rule of our sages of blessed memory, in cases where the halacha vacillates, see what the people do, also does not apply here, for everyone, or every kibbutz, makes its own rules. Of course, I'm not talking about those who do not care about the halacha at all. What is highly desirable, but could hardly be expected in the near future, is a clear and unified attitude within the Orthodox community of the Holy Land to the problem of Shemitah observance in our time. There are a number of points that Diane Grunfeld points out that he thinks that need to change in the attitude of the Kibbutz HaDati. So we know already that there are two schools of thought within the Kibbutz HaDati, one of which has already accepted a change in attitude towards Shemitah, and the majority that really have a different point of view. So the first point that he mentions here is that while it is permitted and it's even meritorious to look into the underlying ideas of the mitzvos, any ideas that we have are really mere conjecture unless the Torah itself tells us that explanation. We never use these ideas in order to understand legal interpretation and practical observance of any of these mitzvos. And the second point quoted here is that it's not permitted to lay down preconditions for the fulfillment of any mitzvah. One of the arguments of members of the kibbutz against full observance of Shemitah is the application of Kant's categorical imperative, and Diane Grunfeld was an expositor of Kant, just like Rav Hirsch was. Act only on that maxim through which you can, at the same time, will that it should become universal law. So accordingly, many leading members of the Kibbutz HaDa'ati feel obligated to consider what would happen if all Jewish farmers were to emulate the example of the Poalei Agudas Yisrael, or if they observe Shemitah exactly like the strict law says that we should observe it. So what would happen? The Yishuv wouldn't exist. So first of all, this is hypothetical. There's no way really to prove it, because it's never been tried before. And second, you need to fulfill Shemitah regardless of what other people do. It's your duty to do what you need to do. And again, as we've pointed out, this is according to the understanding that Shemitah observance today is either Torah law, or, as most say, rabbinic law. But the view that Shemitah is just a pious custom is a minority view. To look down on those who do not use the Heter Mechira and to maintain that they only care for their own group would not be approved of by Rav Kook, whom the leaders of the Kibbutz HaDa'ati have accepted as their Rav. And the reason that we know this is because Rav Kook constantly stressed that even with the Heter Mechira, we need to do everything that we can to go without the Heter Mechira and observe Shemitah as much as we possibly can. Rav Kook, in his letters, never conceived that the Heter Mechira was a general dispensation from the obligation to observe the laws of Shemitah. He said this is Kalis Rosh, V'haparas HaTorah Chalila. It's light-mindedness and annulment of the Torah, God forbid. Rav Kook insisted that each problem concerning agricultural work during Shemitah has to be asked of a Chacham, and as pointed out, he saw no halachic possibility whatsoever to permit sowing during Shemitah. Here's a quote from Rav Kook. Far be it from us to cancel Lehafkia, a great and all-embracing mitzvah like the sanctity of the Shemitah year, without a dire necessity which touches the very survival of many people who might perish, God forbid, for lack of work and sustenance. Rav Kook not only called the Heter Mechira necessary and halachically valid, as he considered it to be in the prevailing circumstances, a far-fetched Heter, a Heter Dachuk, but he warned that it opened up a dangerous road from which it behooves everyone who has a spark of the fear of God in his heart to keep away as much as he can. So clearly we see that Rav Kook did not consider those who tried to observe Shemitah as fully as possible as people who separated themselves from Klal Yisrael. But on the contrary, he was one of the founders of the Keren HaShemitah, whose task it is to help and encourage Jewish farmers who observe Shemitah in accordance with the Halacha. Because as we mentioned, he was of the opinion that any part of the Holy Land, be it ever so small, where Jewish settlers keep the mitzvah of Shemitah in its entirety, lehilchasa, should be a cause for jubilation for us, as if we had discovered the greatest treasure. Traditional Judaism accepts that the underlying idea of a law can never replace its practical observance. So Shemitah, in this respect, is like the weekly Shabbos and all the other laws that are in the Torah. Only people that actually observe them are able to understand them properly and to hand down the divine ideals that are in these mitzvos. Although, during the times of the Mishnah, according to most, Shemitah was rabbinic, our Rabbanim did not refrain from adding restrictions onto the Torah law, such as Svichim. It almost seems that our Chachamim wanted to make amends for the neglect of Shemitah during the days of the first Beis HaMikdash. And this was in spite of the fact that there was a prevalence of great economic difficulties. In his work Sefer HaShemitah, Rav Tukhachinsky reviews many of the halachic and economic positions during Shemitah since the beginning of the new settlement in Eretz Yisrael. And regarding Shemitah in our time. He calls it Shemitah b'tekufas Chevli Mashiach, the Shemitah which precedes the coming of Mashiach, and Chevli Mashiach implies that there's an amount of suffering with it. Rav Tkachinsky suggests that a time may come when there will need to be a special rabbinic assembly to proclaim, like Yanai did, to go out and sow the fields during the Shemitah year. But Rav Tkachinsky makes it clear that only an authoritative assembly of Rabbanim could be entrusted to make such a decision and say whether or not economic stress and danger of life are to such an extent to justify such a course of action. But certainly, we all know that such a decision can never be made by the leaders of individual kibbutzim. Such a rabbinic assembly would clearly need to consult with all the political and economic experts with regard to the security and economic positions of the state. But we could hope in the meantime that those that observe Shemitah will constantly and steadily widen. Just from an ideological point of view, one can make a strong case for the extension of Shemitah observance in our time. The Gemara reports in Sanhedrin that a certain min came before Rabbi Abahu to bother him with certain disrespectful attacks about the honor of God and Yisrael, etc. So in the middle of this, one of Rabbi Abahu's students came and asked him the following question. He said, "What is the reason for the Shemitah year?" So Rabbi Abahu replied, he said, "I shall give you an answer that will suit you both equally. The Holy One, blessed be He, said to Yisrael, 'Plant your seed 6 years, but omit the seventh, that you may know that the earth is mine.'" Rabbi Abahu was known for his knowledge of the Greek language and of Greek culture, and also for his frequent disputations with all sorts of various heretics. And he must have had a special reason why he said that his answer will suit everyone equally. So Dan Grunfeld says that obviously Rabbi Abahu wanted to stress the fact that the recognition of the sovereignty of God, Malchus Shemaim, is expected of every human being because in the view of our Chachamim, it is an absolute necessity for the survival of mankind. We have discussed before the underlying idea of Shemitah and Yovel with the concept of Malchus Shemaim, and we've also drawn attention to the danger in our own time of the idolatry of the nation-state that follows a Machiavellian concept where the political body recognizes no superior, not even moral law. In order to see where such an unlimited concept of national sovereignty could lead, so we could certainly draw attention to the barbaric infringement of human rights by many, many totalitarian states that we are all very familiar with. It's really no surprise that this idea of having unlimited state sovereignty really stands against a world based on justice and recognition of fundamental human rights. I'm just going to read directly inside. "The irreligious secular state, based on a wrong notion of sovereignty, will always tend to consider its interests superior to all claims based on justice, morality, and international law. When it suits the secular state, it will disregard treaties and solemn declarations. There is no other way out of this dilemma of political power but the recognition that the authority from which law is derived is not the state, but God, who is above both states and individuals. Thus, the conception of God is not a mere metaphysical or theological speculation, but assumes stark political reality. It is most significant that the sovereignty of God is a theme which runs throughout the Bible. For sovereignty is the Lord's, and He is ruler over the nations. And the Lord shall be sovereign over all the earth. The heavens will rejoice, and the earth will be glad when they proclaim among the nations the sovereignty of God." Such biblical sentences, it should be realized, are not meant merely as pious and utopian utterances to be used for sermons and millennial speculations during an hour of worship and forgotten afterwards in the realities of life. They are much more real and relevant to human existence and relationships than political leaders are prepared to acknowledge. To anyone who has made a study of world history, it must be evident that there exists a much closer relationship between religious fundamentals and political realities than is generally assumed. Moreover, the biblical vision of a state of world affairs for the realization of which we pray is not merely an eschatological aim to be brought about by a supernatural intervention of God, but a state to be achieved by the ardent endeavor of man in collaboration with God. Mankind is confronted with an unprecedented situation. Political and economic frontiers are disappearing. Parochial nationalism is a thing of the past. National independence is giving way to global interdependence. The deepest insight of the human Bible, namely the unity of mankind, based on the unity of God, has ceased to be a dream, and man is bound to think of himself more and more as a citizen of the world. Man's mastery of atomic power now means either coexistence within a world society or universal co-extinction. So this sounds very Cold War-like, yet at the same time we could totally relate to it when not so long ago, and still currently, North Korea threatens the entire world, and their main goal is atomic power. Continuing, it is in such a situation of the world that the state of Israel was born. If it wants to be a Jewish state, it cannot afford to emulate the example of other modern nation states. It is characteristic that, unlike Greek philosophy and political theory, Judaism, in its classical sources, does not know any speculations about the idea of the state or about which form of state is the best. The reason for this phenomenon is that Judaism puts everything, man, state, and the whole of creation, into the service of a higher idea, the sanctity of human life and the perfection of human morals. For Judaism, the collective personality of the state, like the individual personality of man, must either be in the service of God and the divine moral law, or it has no right to exist. In the biblical narrative of the flood, we find the idea that creation has the purpose of safeguarding justice and morality. As soon as moral depravity and tyranny prevail in human society, creation has failed in its purpose. When the human prophets enunciated the idea of the moral government of the world according to the principle of social justice and surveyed in the light of that idea the history of Israel and of other peoples, they did not conceive a new idea, but only gave immortal expression to what had always been inherent in the philosophy of the Torah. According to that philosophy, Yisrael, as God's people, should be the standard bearer of the cause of a higher and altruistic nationality which recognizes the unity and supremacy of humanity under God. Thus, the sovereignty of God has become the crucial concept for any religious and political thinker who is aware of the perilous situation in which mankind finds itself today. Nearly 17 centuries ago, when the Jewish state lay in ruins, Rabbi Abahu replied to his disciple, who was inquiring for the meaning of the Shemitah year. The Holy One, blessed be He, said to Yisrael, sow your seed 6 years, but omit the seventh year, that you may know that the earth is mine. They, however, did not do so, but sinned and were exiled. A cessation now of all agricultural work during the Shemitah year throughout the reborn Jewish state would be a silent and yet most eloquent homage to the Creator. It would demonstrate to the whole world community not only that God is the real master and owner of the Holy Land, but also that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, the world and they that dwell therein. Could there be a greater Kiddush Hashem? Okay, so this concludes Diane Grunfeld's passionate plea that Shemitah should be observed in its fullest possible way. And next time, we will discuss what you do with exported food that comes from Eretz Yisrael during a Shemitah year.